This is March 27th, 2011. And I'm going to make this teisho about impermanence and the implications of the awareness of impermanence in terms of our practice. Just to mention, I just announced this teisho at the last minute a couple days ago. The reason I'm giving so few teishos these days is because I'm trying to focus all my energy on writing my book. But I also like giving teishos, and so I gave myself a little treat this morning. My wife is out of town, and so there was that variable wasn't there to be concerned about, and it's about a topic that is very, very much on my mind these days with my mother dying. And as it turns out, I ended up spending hours last night anyway going through magazines and books and things that I haven't looked at in a long time to come up with a topic. And I found this in a Buddha Dharma magazine. Buddha Dharma is one of the three, what you could call the national Buddhist magazines. This is from last fall 2010, and the title of the article or the collection of articles is called "How Am I Doing?" And it's written by a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Anyen Rinpoche, A-N-Y-E-N. I've never heard of him, but there are so many. Just as there are so many Zen teachers, that it's not surprising. And there's just something about this article at this time that grabbed me. And that's the key thing. You know, anyone who gives talks probably knows that the most important thing, one of the most important things about choosing a topic, is that it be something meaningful to you. That it get your juices going. The monitors know this from giving encouragement talks, and then, you know, hopefully if it's something that engages you and gets you excited to some degree, then it could have some similar effect on at least a few other people. So he starts, this Anyen Rinpoche, the title, "How Am I Doing?" Basically, the whole little collection of short articles is a recommendation of self-reflection about one's practice and one's life. This is a more common thing in Tibetan Buddhism than in Zen or Vipassana Buddhism, this practice of reflecting. Zen in the purest sense is just being fully present right in this moment with what's right in front of us. But I do think that there's a place for reflection, and that's why I'm using this article as a touchstone in this teisho. As usual, I'll have to skip much of the material just because of the limitations of time. But just to get into this, it begins, I'll just read the introductory paragraph. "It has been almost 50 years since many lamas of my parents' and grandparents' generation crossed the borders of Tibet and changed the spiritual face of the West forever. The early students of Tibetan Buddhism here in the United States, now my adopted home, are advancing both in their practice and in their years. While death can surely arrive at any moment, for many, the truth of impermanence is just now beginning to dawn with some clarity, with some certainty. the true test of their faith and practice is beginning. And then he opens with some questions that we can ask ourselves. How have we changed? How have we worked with obstacles that have arisen along the way? Have we slipped back into any unwholesome habitual patterns and not even noticed? What kind of faith do we find in our hearts right now? What is our current commitment to practice? Where do we want to be as Dharma practitioners at the time of our death? And then he goes on to a... here's just a little bit more about him. The little blurb says, Anyen Rinpoche is a Kenpo master scholar, originally from Tibet. He now lives in Colorado. And this article is from his new book, Dying with Confidence, apparently was already came out last fall. The first, back to the value of assessing ourselves from time to time. He says we must be careful about having only the appearance of a Dharma practitioner. Some students who have received many teachings tell me they are on and off practitioners. They sort of practice and have little experience. This, over the years, I've come to realize that this is very common in our Sangha, people who sort of practice. It's so funny how many people in their minds consider themselves Zen practitioners, but who don't really practice much. This is a real kind of self-deceit. It's a Zen because it's kind of cool. It becomes we tend to cling to it as part of our self-image, our ego. That's what ego is: self-image. And so many people, either they'll say to other people or just in their own minds, they'll think of themselves as into Zen or whatever, however they think of it, but they don't practice much. So you can see it doesn't really jibe. The two don't go together. If you're really into Zen, then you're sitting regularly. It's so common, and there are reasons for it that we'll touch on later. Sometimes they are very passionate about their practice for a short period of time. They may burn like fire, but then something or other happens and they stop practicing. They lack certainty about what is the perfectly pure path, whatever that means. We need to abandon this habit of being an on and off practitioner. If we let our energy get too high, we can expect a counterbalancing low to follow when we lose our enthusiasm. Thus, in terms of Dharma practice, having a tempered passion is a more useful quality. But how? I can hear people asking that. Sure, I know I should be sitting every day, but I can't get myself to do it. We've brought this up so many teishos. The short answer is it's not easy. If you can sit with others, if you can come to the center, if you're here and you can come to the center, it is supportive. It's helpful to sit with others in all kinds of ways. It's hard to sit at home alone. But many people find it's also hard to get here. I think in the end, it's so much a matter of the pain that you feel. And the pain can be something that is painful now at this moment, or it can be the pain of the awareness of our impermanence, the certainty of our death and the uncertainty of the time of our death. Either one can work. Of course, they're both present pain. Being acutely and painfully aware of the impermanent nature of life is experienced as pain now, but there's also just the pain of relationships, current relationships, and difficulties with other people and self-consciousness one feels. I'm speaking from experience, what got me going. So we're going to talk more about the kind of awareness of impermanence as we go on now. But in the end, I think it's just pain. You can have it all figured out, and you can be completely sold on Zen. It makes so much sense. It makes so much sense that the quality of our lives is determined by our ability to live in the present, be fully present and attentive and aware. And the quality of our service to others, our ability to help others, likewise, is so much determined by our ability to be fully present and not caught in our thoughts. We all get this. Certainly everyone hearing this gets this, but it's the follow-through that is so hard for so many people. But then it gets easier to do that when you're really suffering. Roshi Kapil used to make the point, a very good one, I think, that you could say that everyone needs Zen practice or some kind of meditation practice. Let's just broaden it a little bit. But few people, for few people, is it a felt need? How few people are aware of the need, and I'm convinced that when all is said and done, it's pain that drives us into practice. That's why I believe it makes so much sense that pain is the first of the Four Noble Truths. That's where it starts. We have to feel this discontent, dissatisfaction with ourselves, our lives. And then he talks about having a Dharma vision, which he defines as an evolving meditation on living and dying. I think what he means by this is being aware of the importance of practice and with a sense of how we're going to live with that, how we're going to fulfill it, how we're going to apply it to our lives. I'm skipping here quite a bit. He talks about having a Dharma will, literally a document stating our wishes for spiritual care as we are dying and immediately after our death. This Dharma will, he said, should include instructions for our and trusted Dharma friends and for non-Buddhist family and friends, and requests concerning the ceremonies and prayers at our burial or cremation. And he gets into some detail there that we don't have time to get into. And he even mentions having a Dharma box physically, a box that contains all the items that we and our entrusted Dharma friends will need to help us actualize our Dharma vision and carry out our Dharma will at the time of death. If people who are hearing this have an interest in knowing more about that, I can make this available somehow. Maybe just photocopying this and having piles of it available in the link or whatever. And then before we get into the contemplations about impermanence and practice, just a couple paragraphs here. When you've thoroughly explored each of the contemplations, you can begin to incorporate what you have learned about yourself as a practitioner into your Dharma vision. Even if you have been practicing for a long time, you may be surprised at what you find lacking in your practice when you have taken an honest look. Many of my students find great inspiration in this process to increase their diligence and to focus on areas needing attention. This is, I think, one of the great values of having repentance ceremonies. It forces you, if you take them at all seriously, it forces you to examine yourself and to acknowledge areas of deficiency in terms of thoughts and actions. Not deficiency of character, exactly. That's something that we can keep working with and changing, but just ways that we fall short of living up to what we know we are capable of. It's also one of the great benefits of participating in the term intensive, these twice yearly periods of intensified practice, 3 weeks and 5 weeks are the length of the two lengths in which we commit to step it up, mainly in our sitting, because everything comes from the sitting, but possibly in other ways too. And then he says, don't forget to practice compassion for yourself. Appreciate the past efforts you have already made and include the efforts you are willing to make to become the excellent practitioner you have envisioned. One of the biggest obstacles we might find we have as practitioners is that we lack a sense of urgency about the need to practice. This is caused by our strong experience of self-attachment. Self-attachment is expressed in many different ways. For example, we might think, let me just enjoy my life right now. Let me enjoy this particular moment. So that's what we would see played out when we're trying to decide whether, say, to go to an evening sitting or stay at home surfing the web or watching TV or anything else. We put off practice for a later time, which we fail to realize may never come. The best time to practice, the best time to prepare for the reality of death, and the best time to clarify our own Dharma visions is the present. Don't waste a moment. We have it on the Bahan, the wooden block here outside the Zendo. Read it 1,000 times and I still have to try to remember what it says. I got the spirit of it though. Great is the matter of life and death. Life slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Don't waste a moment. Wake up, wake up. There's a Chinese proverb, discipline begins with the fear of death. He also says, before we get to that fear of death, he says, having a sense of urgency about practice could cause us to overestimate ourselves or to want to skip over the hard work of developing a solid and stable base of daily practice. As you create your Dharma vision, make an effort to balance idealism with realism. This is what I emphasize so much on our website about crafting a pledge or several pledges for the term intensive, is to balance idealism with realism. He says, we may all wish to be great yogis like Milarepa and Longchenpa. Let's make it Rinzai and Dogen. But our capacity is more likely to be one of an ordinary practitioner. So we should reflect realistically on where we are now in our practice and what kind of practitioner we wish to become that is not beyond our reach. We must be honest about our capacity and realistic in our goals. This is why at workshops I always urge people, and as did Roshi Kaplow, to start modestly, just a little every day, little bit every day. And if you can do that, then you will notice some changes, some positive changes, and then that is the best impetus to increase a little, gradually increase the amount of sitting you do. We must also continually be mindful of life's impermanence and the reality of impending death. We may not have all the time we think we will have for practice. Henry Miller somewhere said, life, as it is called, is for most of us one long postponement. And then he presents ideas to contemplate. Now, let me just preface this by saying that if we don't need to contemplate these things, our death, the impermanence of things, if we are practicing ardently hours a day, then we don't need the contemplation, the self-reflections. But if we're not practicing as much and as seriously as we think we can, then these things can just be little ways of boosting our efforts. It's somewhat like reading. The question among beginners, a common question is, how much reading should I do? And the answer I always give is that if you're in a dry period in your practice, if you're stalled out and you find it hard to get the motivation or the interest in sitting, then some reading, some good reading can get us back on track. Reading books recommended. We have books recommended here at the center. It doesn't need to take very much. I remember this in my early years of feeling like a little discouraged. I would just open the Three Pillars of Zen or some other book that is written out of someone's realization, and I could read three pages, and it would be enough to get me back to the mat. And this too, you don't have to spend all day reflecting on these things. Sometimes if you're wobbling, you don't know, should I sit, should I not sit, then just stopping yourself and just considering these things can make the difference. So the first category he brings up that I won't read from because I don't need to, is reflecting on the impermanence of things outside us, so-called. And this is, it's all around us, all the time. Of course, the obvious is reflecting on, is when someone close to us is seriously ill or has died. That's the ultimate reminder of impermanence. It doesn't have to be someone close to us. It can be celebrities. I see people respond sometimes that it really has an impact on them to hear that so-and-so, who used to be such a sex symbol or one way or another, men or women, that, and you know, back in the whatever, 30s or 40s or 50s or whatever, that they're, they just died. You hear this on the news. Elizabeth Taylor died last week. And that's some people can be affected by that. Huh. It can be a shock because we carry outdated images of these people in our minds, of people who are just brimming with vitality and beauty and luster and strength, and then we hear that, as Shakespeare said, golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. We can just notice the seasons. We're blessed here with this additional reminder of impermanence, which they don't have everywhere. As the seasons change, especially fall, this is what I notice the most is it during the fall of seeing the passing of things and the four cardinal points of the year, the summer and winter solstices and the spring and fall equinoxes, can be little moments to stop and realize that we don't know how much longer, how many more equinoxes and solstices we're going to see. And just the trees, the plants, all the things that change through the seasons. And to notice, to sometimes notice that even things there are things that will outlive us. I remember the first time, it was during Taisho, when I realized that this lectern will undoubtedly outlive me. When I'm gone, this will still be here. Short of fire or tsunami. Pretty safe on the tsunami thing, I think. Furniture. Householders have the advantage of seeing things deteriorating all the time around them, having to have them fixed. And then there are all the things about our own self that are on full display as we age. The gray hair, the failing eyesight, the memory loss, the way that when we strain something, injure ourselves or pull a muscle or something, it takes longer to heal, doesn't it? Even just weight gain, to see how clothes that fit us 3 years ago no longer fit us. These are all signs that we can use to remind ourselves of what we don't want to face is that we are constantly declining, decaying. This is the Dharma. Everything is, there's birth, there's growth, there's decline, and there's death. This is the nature of things. And we live in a culture that is obsessed with youth. It is constantly, all the messages we're getting is glorifying youth. And to that degree, there is a denial of aging and death. So it's as we get older that these things become harder to deny, because we're embodying them. We're embodying this impermanence. And yet we have such a capacity to deny. So whether it's people on the outside, things on the outside, people who are close to us or not close to us, or things, or our own body minds, the trick is to really notice these things and mentally assimilate them. This is when they have the power to get us on track and get us to reorient ourselves and find the priorities in our lives. Oh, I got off track here from the article. Then he says, you can also contemplate impermanence from the inner point of view. Imagine yourself as a small baby. See the physical changes you have gone through until now. And here's a good one. Sometimes looking at photos of yourself from childhood to the present can be a poignant way to examine your own physical impermanence. Look at the transformation that has occurred in you physically. Then think about your physical being from last year until now, from last month until now, from yesterday until today. See that your body is changing even from moment to moment. And then we can look up a generation and down a generation also. I found myself recently reflecting on the fact that when I came to the center, Roshi Kaplo was 5 years younger than I am now. He seemed so old at the time, this old guy. He's 5 years younger than I am now. Yeesh. Here's another one. I'll just quote Ogden Nash. Middle age is when you've met so many people that every new person you meet reminds you of someone else. And then down the generation, parents have this perspective of seeing their children grow. And often that the growth, you know, measuring them against the wall, making the mark and seeing how the marks climb up the wall, this can be thrilling to a parent. I remember my parents being so excited for me or for them that, you know, I was getting taller. But then there are those other times. I've heard that many parents have a rough day when they're child toddles off to kindergarten for the first time, not to mention going off to college, leaving home. I've heard, talked to a number of parents who were left sobbing when their kids went off. contemplate impermanence, he says, from the secret point of view. That's some old word translation. Basically saying, reflect on the wild nature of your own mind. This is what we have a chance to do every time we sit or are otherwise aware of the unstable nature of the mind, how thoughts and images and feelings form and then pass through. This is our most intimate look at impermanence. I remember my father telling me once that when he was leaving, getting dressed to go to work on a day when he was dreading a certain big meeting or something, that as he laced up his shoes, he would tell himself, when I unlace these shoes, it'll be behind me. Probably everyone knows that little trick. Contemplate your spiritual practice. Reflect on your daily practice. Are you practicing regularly and for as long as you would like? Reflect deeply on what type of practitioner you really want to be. What are the obstacles that stand in your way? Think about any tendencies you have that prevent you from practicing in this way. What is the main cause? Identify the things that cause you to put off practicing. Then contemplate the impermanence of things to which you are attached. If you are attached to material objects in the world around you, reflect on their changing nature. If you are attached to a person, reflect on him or her growing old and dying. Actually envision his or her physical and mental changes. In my experience, these reflections, these contemplations arise naturally. I'll just speak for myself. They have, over the years, they increasingly arise on their own. They don't have to set about to reflect on these things as a kind of to-do list. That maybe that's the effect of a long practice, is that the denial, as the denial fades, as our the veil of denial gets thinner, then we just see what has always been there all around us. We notice more. G.K. Chesterton, the British writer and philosopher and critic, he said, "To love anything is to see it at once under the lowering clouds of danger." I frequently, every day, I'm aware of this in terms of my wife, that it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. No one gets out of this free. It's the price of attachment. But what's the alternative? To isolate yourself from others? To crawl into a shell and this also came to me with great force when my father died. It's the realization that, okay, attachment, as the Buddha said, attachment breeds suffering. With parents, you don't have a choice. You get attached. From the day you take your first breath, you are enmeshed with your parents. Deeply, deeply attached. You might imagine that as an adult, you can choose to live as a hermit, but not with your parents. So we are bound to suffer. This is the nature of life, of human life. It's getting attached and then losing the person. We can only hope that it happens in the right order. There's a story in Zen about a man who came to a Zen master, or I don't know, a Taoist master, doesn't matter. Just listen to the story. And he said, "What is the most wonderful thing?" And the master said, "Grandfather dies, father dies, son dies." I can't imagine the pain of losing a child. No one can, I suppose, who doesn't have children, but I suppose no one who hasn't lost a child can begin to know it. I have to skip more than I wanted to, just because I don't want to keep people too long. But just a little more here. And he talks about reflecting on the past month's practice. It's a nice kind of middle time span. It's not just an hour a day. It's not a year. Contemplate this past month's spiritual practice in terms of anger. This is, again, something that we have a chance to do with repentance ceremonies. And also with Jukai, taking the precepts. Contemplate the death of a pet or animal you love. Imagine that an animal you love very much is ill and close to dying, or considering what is happening in our world today, think that the last of an entire species you love is about to die. Recognize that animals have no way to take care of themselves, spiritually or mentally, in this situation. It is not that they do not want to, they are simply incapable of doing so. With compassion for their suffering, also reflect on your good fortune in being born as a human being who can take care of yourself emotionally and spiritually at the time of death. Contemplate the death of a person you love. You may have already experienced the death of someone you are close to. Perhaps they did not have all the spiritual support they needed to die without fear or regret. That's one reason that I could justify leaving my mother and her condition, is having the blessing of having a whole flock of sisters there who are attending to her. Four of the five of whom have done a lot of Dharma practice, either in Zen or Tibetan Buddhism. Contemplate the causes and conditions that led to your birth and will lead to your death. Take time to imagine yourself in the dying process. Do you have the confidence to die well? Are you ready? You don't have to imagine this if you go to Sesshin. Sesshin is dying. It's as close, I'm absolutely convinced, it's as close as we can ever get to dying. It's a dry run of dying. And we find out how prepared we are. And we find that by going to Sesshin, because it's so intense, we get better at it. We get better at dying. We learn to die, which is the same as learning to live. It's learning to let go. Let go of our thoughts. Let go of ourself. lose ourselves. Finally, contemplate your relationship with a spiritual friend. That's another Buddhist word for a teacher. If you have had the good fortune to meet and make a strong connection to a spiritual teacher, reflect on this relationship and what it is like now. Have you developed the kind of relationship you envision? If not, what can you do to develop this relationship further? And then he says that he suggests that each year you commit to reviewing your vision as a Dharma practitioner, assessing your progress, and seeing if there is anything new you want to add. Let me just end with, on a kind of a positive note, that impermanence works for us too, right? I mean, it's change. We can change. And the things that are painful are going to change. Our wounds and our injuries are going to pass. War is going to pass. I heard the other day someone say there are two wonderful things about war: when it starts and when it ends. It's everything in between that's so hellish. Winter's going to end. I'm almost sure of it. Nuclear waste will end too, but not for a long, long time. There's so much discussion, of course, now about the insecurity of nuclear plants. I believe the experts that they are remarkably safe. Enormous, even Al Gore, favors nuclear plants. But even aside from the million-year flood or the earthquake or whatever, even leaving those aside, what about the waste? This is something you don't hear too much, especially now when everyone's focused on the plants, the nuclear plants themselves. But what, you just can't just keep parking this toxic waste in the earth, our Mother Earth, for nothing. There's going to be an effect from that. And as we get older and older and the body and mind start breaking down, even that, we can find reason, we can appreciate impermanence, because we're gonna, well, if you can buy into rebirth, then we're gonna get another shot at it. I found myself saying this to my mother, who is in, she's not really talking anymore. She's very near death. And I said to her, I thought, okay, she's pretty level-headed. And I said, Mom, you need a new body. And there was no response because she's not responding. But later, my sisters reported to me that she had later murmured to them, one of them, I need a new body. And they felt it was helpful to her. So there's a little tip. I don't know if people are different, but it could be helpful if your parent or friend or spouse can buy into rebirth at all. Then I believe it completely. You know, there comes a time when we need a new model. We need a new body, mind, and if you can believe in rebirth, then it's very reassuring to know that we will. And then there's just the impermanence of grief itself. When we lose someone, the grief that seems so overwhelming, it's so bottomless, especially if it isn't someone who's very, very aged. The grief itself will pass. I was recently talking with a woman in the Sangha who lost her husband when he was, this is about 3 years ago, he was 50 or 45 or something like that, and sudden cancer death. And I talked with her a lot in the months, the weeks and months after that loss, and she was suffering terribly. She didn't make any, she didn't deny it. She felt like it was, she could never ever again enjoy life the way she, in the depths. She's left with three kids. But then that was 3 years ago. I talked to her recently. She says, yeah, I'm fine. It passes. I never thought it would, but it does. She said that one of the best images she was given when she was in the middle of it was from another person who had lost her husband. And the person said, grief is like a balloon. It gets lighter and lighter until you couldn't hold on to it even if you wanted to. All right, our time is more than up. I'll stop now and recite the four vows.